Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
And I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team on Android. And today we have
Adam Powell, also of the Toolkit team.
Which you talked to us, what it must be like 3 years ago or so about, I don't even remember.
I usually talk to you more than that.
Unfortunately for you.
Until the lawyers stepped in. You talked to us on the podcast about, no, it's I'm drawing a blank.
No. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway.
I will assume something. It was about fragments.
Yeah, sure.
Recycle view?
One of those probably.
Anyway, nowadays, you have been working for quite a while on Jetpack Compose.
That's right.
So why don't we go ahead and talk about that today?
But how would you, can you, well, we talked about Jetpack Compose on the podcast before, but in your own words, what is Compose? Because it's always interesting to ask several people what they think it is.
So Compose to me is kind of taking everything that we've been doing with Vue's over the past 10 years and kind of learning from it. Trying to take all the things that have been a real kind of pain in the neck for us, for developers, and to try and make that a better experience, the sort of thing that you would want to sit down and do in your spare time, not just because you're getting paid.
It's a very positive spin on it. I like it.
So what are aspects that make that better then? How are we improving upon the current way of writing UI code?
I think the first one is really leveraging Kotlin and kind of all the things that you can do with it to start with and just kind of considering that a baseline. It's really kind of enabling us to start from the point of writing less code and then being able to go further with that through the use of a specialized compiler plugin to allow us to go kind of even further than what Kotlin normally would allow for. We're able to rewrite function calls in such a way that allows functions to sort of do dual duty, both as a bit of a builder, a factory, and also kind of an updater of an active piece of UI.
Yeah, there's something quite liberating about creating classes only for your data as opposed to for your logic.
Right. So at that point, the functions that you write are just transformations on the data to reflect that data out back to the user.
So you said Kotlin was, you know, obviously a strong part of this, but clearly there is more about sort of making UI programming or view programming easier. So what are other elements just sort of set the groundwork here?
So Compose takes a very declarative programming style to begin with. So instead of writing a series of setters, a series of operations to sort of push data to the views where the views sort of maintain those over time, and you have kind of this idea where views are holders of state themselves. In Compose, it's considered a lot more stateless the way that you write your code. You write your code just saying, here's the current state of the data that backs whatever I'm showing to the user.
Okay, so this is one of the things I think is interesting to understand because, yes, when we talk about Compose, we talk about the, you know, declarative programming model and blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, I'm looking at my layout files and they're declarative. Like by design, we created this essentially language or syntax in XML that you could use to have a declarative way of saying, this is my UI. And then there's the code for handling the logic. So what's the difference between that declarative versus the Compose declarative?
We're able to bring the rest of the declarative code into the same location.
Well, the layouts are, I would say, are statically declarative, right? You can declare a state of the UI with XML, but it won't evolve past that. To change that state, you have to write code, and that code has to like do the find view by ID, call the setters, and all that stuff.
Romain, remember when we used to talk about what it would look like to use XML to define a list view adapter?
Yes, a long time ago.
So stateful declarative, is there a new phrase that we need? Stateful declarative or stateless declarative? Dynamic declarative. Okay, there it is.
So it's kind of what we learned from doing a lot of the things along data binding as well. Like when we started extending data binding to include small expressions, things to be able to perform some basic string formatting to fetch properties out of a particular object, so on and so forth. We wanted to be very, very tightly scoped with that. And we didn't want to bring like an entire programming language into XML for some of that. But as you're trying to format data, as you're trying to sort of fetch and mash up data from other parts of your application, at some point you reach the point where you just do need to write real code in order to format all of that effectively and be able to sort of see all of that co-located in one place so that you're not constantly switching back and forth between files to try to make sense of how that's getting wired up.
Right. So actually, the mention of data binding is interesting because what we started doing was piercing the veil of the static declarative stuff that we had, where all of a sudden now we're putting coding logic in the declarative files, and then it started to blur the lines.
And it made some people very angry.
Yeah, and to Adam's point, it's, you know, then it becomes weird. You have this XML syntax that's very static and very declarative, and you start injecting that other language that kind of looks like Java. It's not quite Java because it has its own like syntax on top of it. Yeah. So, and the further you go down that path, the weirder it gets. And you start running into limitations, and it becomes awkward.
And you start writing special code that's just for talking to that piece of your data binding XML as
exactly,
well.
Exactly. Yeah, so because it becomes complicated. Yeah, you write your special APIs in Java that you call from data binding, and yeah, it doesn't scale very well.
Okay, so what we're doing instead of dragging the logic into the declarative stuff, we're dragging the declarative stuff into the code. And somehow that's better. So help me understand the difference now in a Compose application between aspects of your code that are declarative versus aspects of your code. Well, there is still dynamic logic somewhere. Where is that happening?
I mean, anywhere you want. Define dynamic in that case, too.
Well, happening at runtime, right, is the aspect that Clemai was talking about.
Yes. I mean, like, at some point, Compose is still dealing with compiled code. I mean, like, sure, you can write an interpreter out of whatever you've got as well if you really felt like it. But I mean, like, static versus dynamic, I guess I'm trying to tease out a little bit more definitions there because I think that the lines are very artificial. And I think Compose kind of leans into that idea that the lines really are kind of artificial and imposed by the technology in a lot of ways.
So maybe we drive it through an example. So let's say you have an application that post videos about cats. And
who would write one of those?
You get a notification that there is a new video posted which needs to show up in the UI. So somewhere in your code, there's a piece of logic somewhere that says, hey, there's something new on the server and I need to serve it to the UI. So there is state that has changed. There's logic that needs to react to that change. There's UI that needs to be updated. So where is the dynamic logic? Where is the declarative UI stuff? How do they integrate together? If you want to change the example, feel free. I just feel that cats are a really powerful metaphor.
I'm just going to lose a bet if I start talking too much about coroutines or RxJava or something here as part of the example that you gave. So I'm trying to think of an example that doesn't involve something like that.
I mean, coroutines are sort of an implementation detail of an idea, right?
Well, there's kind of a question of what does your UI look like now in terms of a snapshot? And what does your data model look like over time? And how do those changes over time affect your UI? I think that there's a lot of code that's kind of devoted to the idea of managing the difference of what happens over time and not being able to act in terms of the snapshots of now. So you give the example of I need to be showing a notification for one thing or another. And in a lot of ways, you can think of that as you only have one state. It's like, am I showing a notification or am I not? Do I have a notification or do I have a null? What is it that I'm actually showing? And how to get from one versus the other is kind of that over time aspect. And that's one of the things that Compose tries to address and sort of work for you under the hood to manage a little bit more of that automatically so that you can think in terms of how data is flowing through your system over time. And Compose becomes kind of an endpoint for that data to say that at the very end, before you show these pixels to the user, here's the transformation step that turns it into a nice, beautiful, structured UI that shows you all the data. And here's what it looks like at any given snapshot in time. Not necessarily a question of when you're writing a recycler view adapter, you spend a bunch of time making sure that you're rebinding every last subview, every last property of a subview, because something in there might be stale. You're reusing things. And it's nice to not have to think about those sorts of deltas over time.
Yeah, another way to think about it, so it's data-driven, and the Compose runtime takes care of the data dependencies, right? So if you use a piece of data in the declaration of your UI, if that data changes, we're going to rerun the declaration of the UI as if you were starting from scratch. You know, if we go a little deeper in the example that Adam was talking about, like I think Jim used that example several times. Let's say, you know, you have an icon and you want like an unread count, like a little badge on it. Like, you know, in the typical fashion with the existing system, you would say, okay, is the badge showing? If it's already showing and I don't have to show it anymore, then I need to hide it. If it's showing and it's showing the wrong number, then I need to update it. If it's not showing and, you know, I need to show it, then I need to make it appear. So you have all this logic Whereas with the with Compose, you don't do any of that. All you do is like, if the badge needs to show, it shows, and that's it, right? Because you're starting, you assume that you're starting from scratch. You don't have to remember like, where was I before and adapt to that.
Right. That's where you have a statement that looks like, if has badge data, badge the badge data.
Yeah, or if like, am I currently selected, set selected, not selected, that kind of stuff. And that's where a lot of like bugs come from in UIs. It's like many, like you're basically juggling between the new state and the old state, and you have to somehow transition from one to the other yourself.
Well, not even if bugs, it's not bugs, it's a lot of boring code to write.
It's all, that, yeah. Exactly.
But that's also part of why bugs come from it, because, you know, it's easy to just not be interested in that.
Right. And you can get lost in that amount of boilerplate that you kind of have to slog through day by day. It's like, if you need to make a change to something and you need to do it quickly, then you don't want to have to sit there and sift through for the code that you're actually looking for. And as powerful as kind of like our abilities to search through source bases are these days, it's still work.
And it makes the code a lot more readable, because then, you know, you read the code and you see, oh, if the number of unread emails is greater than zero, show badge, like, you know, put the badge on. And like, you understand when you read that, like what the UI is going to look like. But if you see like that cascade of each statement that check, well, was it visible? Is it not visible? Sometimes it can be very hard to figure out like, okay, what is it? What is this piece of code doing exactly?
I mean, I'm thinking if we had Compose to clean up the logic that we had for invalidation flags inside of Vue.java,
for instance,
maybe we could have avoided a lot of bugs in the past. So what I'm hearing is Compose will eliminate bugs. Is that?
It'll
all bugs. That's I think that's what I heard.
All bugs, yeah, entirely.
All bugs. Okay, cool. That's a good claim. It'll look good on the marketing brochure.
Yeah. So I mean, you mentioned, for example, managing invalidation flags everywhere. Yeah. This is one of those things where I think we were really able to learn from a lot of the hard lessons of the Vue system. Like, how many different types of invalidation are there in Vue's jet? Do you remember?
Well, I mean, there's invalidate and request layout.
At least those two. Yeah. And then not only that, but then there's the way that it cascades up the tree and how much of something gets invalidated.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And then like more dirty wrecks, everything else. Right, exactly. But the thing is that you start accumulating these different types of invalidations over time to be able to say, what's clean, what's dirty, how much work do I need to do?
Yep.
And Roman was starting to talk about kind of one of the things that Compose will do, and we'll go ahead and track changes to specifically marked objects within your Compose UI kind of over time. So we're able to perform very fine-grained invalidations based on your data that kind of fed into that, rather than people having to remember to set the right flags if they're writing custom enough code.
Okay. So something else you'd mentioned earlier was the Kotlin. So the first here you said, well, you know, it's going to be better because we use all this Kotlin capability, which is going to make the code better magically. So details? Like what are the aspects of Kotlin that lend itself to Compose being an easier or better or more enjoyable experience to write code in?
I mean, you start from the standpoint of like the concept of a DSL is very native to Kotlin. The idea that you can open a trailing lambda block as part of something and it becomes a code or becomes a control structure. You can define things that look and feel like control structures within a library rather than have to be a language designer to do them. So that kind of kicks things off in some ways.
So is there a DSL for Compose then? I didn't follow that.
In some ways, Compose is a DSL or a tool for building even more DSLs on top of.
Okay. So
it's a DSL in the sense like, you know, if you've seen Compose code, every time you, especially with the containers, like you create a row, right? You say row, you open the curly brace, and then you put logic and other widgets, you know, well, calls to composables inside. And so that opening the curly brace, you're just creating a lambda that you pass to the raw container. And that's where the DSL kicks in. And that's what helps us create like this visual structure of the declaration of your UI. Okay. But you're just invoking functions and giving them lambdas. But it does look like your UI.
So I had this interesting experience, which you remember, where a talk that I gave recently with James Ward. We were writing this demo, and it was going to show some Compose stuff as, you know, an element of a bunch of Kotlin stuff that we were doing. And I ran into some problems where like it wasn't understanding that I was updating the state and it was supposed to magically do this. And then I realized, oh, I started from a project that was not a Compose project, and I forgot to add all the compiler stuff. And the weird part to me was it didn't matter in terms of the syntax. Like it could build the application that I wanted to, and it could use Compose functions and syntax and semantics and like do everything that I wanted except the magic of the underlying compiler.
Yeah, we're going to break that really soon.
Okay, so that was sort of my question was like, well, this isn't a DSL. This was just Kotlin language and libraries that I was using. So what does that?
DSL is a marketing term for it's just Kotlin language and library. Yes.
Okay. All right.
So it's of a specific style, more or less.
But I think of DSLs, I mean, maybe this is getting a little in the weeds, but I think of DSLs as we define sort of new things that look like language structures, but allow you to, you know, work in this new language and yet it all just, you know, magically
but
builds
that's the key.
Into Kotlin.
Kotlin as a language has enough built-in functionality. So, you know, like the infix operators, the trailing lambdas and various other things, the scoping.
Ability to not have parentheses.
Right. That lets you build effectively DSLs, but all the Kotlin DSLs abide by the same rules, you know, in a way, because they all build on the same fundamental primitives. Nobody writes their own parser or compiler or anything like that.
Right.
And that's not specific to Kotlin, right? Other languages like Groovy, for instance, that's what Gradle is. Gradle is a DSL written in Groovy. But you can put Groovy code inside your Gradle file because it's just Groovy.
Okay. But, I mean, have you done anything specifically around a composed DSL, or is it just using DSL-like capabilities of Kotlin, the language, to make everything look more readable, essentially?
So I guess from a certain lens, yes, we kind of have. I think that any time that we have our layout containers, for example, that is a form of DSL. We've defined that the trailing lambda of a particular layout container, like a row or column or something like that, is the...
It's the children, right?
Exactly. It's the block of content for whatever that layout is.
Okay. I mean, I would call that a convention that happens to use the Kotlin language feature that allows you to drop that lambda outside the parentheses. Is that correct?
Well, exactly. But as you build that into a series of conventions in a particular library and you build a consistent API around it, that becomes a DSL.
Oh, epiphany. Okay. All right.
Chet learns new things. That should be the name of the podcast.
It is the subtext.
Things you should have known.
Wait, Tor's about to say something. He hasn't said much today. Go ahead.
What's new with Compose?
What's new with Compose?
Since...
Well, I'm thinking that our last talk on Compose, I think was probably
June.
In the summer. It was after I.O., right? And then we had the Android Dev Summit, but I don't think we actually talked much about the things we showed there happened in the few months since. Because you're doing this development in the open, as I understand it, on iOS.
A small recap of the timeline. So Google I.O., we announced that we were working on Compose. We made the code source available, and that was it. At ADS, we released binaries and a version of Android Studio, Android Studio 4.0 Canary 1. Mm-hmm. With tools inside, and then you could use Compose without compiling it yourself. So, Adam, what was in that first release of Compose at ADS, and what have we done since then?
So the ADS release had kind of like a rough snapshot in time of where we were at with sort of building these UI DSLs and also an implementation of the compiler plugin that kind of linked against a special EAP version of Kotlin C at the time. We're kind of in the process of upstreaming all of the extension points to Kotlin C master to make sure that these extension points are available for plugin authors for everybody. We had the APIs in place for doing kind of basic UIs, and we're experimenting. I mean, like we're kind of going through some iterative processes of like user studies to see how discoverable and usable some of these APIs are, and we're continuing to make changes based on those. And some of the things are just kind of internal cleanup as well. Like we had a special system for doing what we called effects of when you have a composable function, so it kind of participates in this call rewriting so that we know whether or not we're actually performing like a new instance creation of something kind of under the hood more or less or conceptually versus updating some existing construct in your UI. So we do a little bit of like remembering across the composition in order to accomplish some of this. And there was an alternate way of tying into this that we just called effects that we're able to actually return values. So we would use this to sort of like read these tree local values that we call ambients from other parts in the tree that we use to implement some things like styles and themes and things like that. And those have now kind of become unified with composable functions. And now we've just got kind of one additional concept that we've added. So now a composable function can just return a value and then there's nothing else particularly special about it.
Can I summarize that to you got rid of the weird plus syntax?
We got rid of the plus syntax.
Okay, all right.
So a minus on the plus.
So we actually have a conservation of plus operators throughout this. So we had to add it back someplace else. So as we started talking about this idea of like layout modifiers for like ways of doing layout params in concompose. Now, instead of having this weird little wraps infix operator for concatenating them, now you can just concatenate it with the plus. So it's a little bit more consistent
plus
with like
binary operator. Okay, I'm back.
Yes.
Okay, because the unary one was the one that I was.
No, it's for concatenation, consistent with lists.
Oh, that's totally
else.
Fine. That's,
yeah.
Am I right in my memory that like the plus was the indicator that there is state that could change, and then that became a trigger to the compiler?
The plus was kind of like this weird joining operator that would, so you would have an effect, or you would have a function that returns an effect, just a normal Kotlin function that returns a special object of type effect. And the unary plus operator, when used there, would basically say, hey, invoke this effect. So just like if you have a function type object in Kotlin, you can call dot invoke on it, or you can put paren paren after it to actually call this thing. The plus was essentially like the call or invoke or join this into the composition type of operator for effects at the time.
Okay, so the answer is no, you're not correct, Chet. That is the wrong memory. Okay.
Well, more specifically, the answer is the plus was really confusing for a whole ton of reasons, so we got rid of it.
Well, and Chet, you were also right, because the most common effect was memorizing state, and so that's why the plus showed a lot in front of plus state or plus memo.
Okay, so what is the mechanism? So since the plus is taken out, what's the mechanism that the compiler uses to understand that? This composable monitored state that could change, and therefore I need to reinvoke this. I need to call this again if that variable changes, if that state changes.
A whole lot of things. So we've got things that are monitoring state. We've got this concept of like these framed objects that are annotated with an app model annotation. So the idea is that all the objects that you have in your process at a time that are that have their class annotated as app model have some extra code gen that happens. That means that any writes that happen to those objects are tracked, and or any reads that are that happen to those objects can also be tracked. So during composition, we are tracking reads, and we're tracking it on a fairly fine-grained level. So whenever you have like a block of code, more or less, that ends up either directly or even transitively, like many, many layers down the call stack, it ends up performing a read on an app model object. Yep. We track that. And
that's
say that
what I meant earlier by data dependencies.
Yeah, exactly. So this is where we get like this super fine-grained invalidation. We're not invalidating that, I have to redraw. We're invalidating the data that fed into the draw operation in the first place.
Okay.
So that way we know that data changed. So we know that we, not just that we need to redraw, but that we need to redraw this one specific thing because this was the thing that depended on that data in the first place.
Okay. So if I have an app model foo and some composable somewhere declares a local variable within the context of that composable that is of type foo, then it will automatically be reinvoked if foo changes.
Right. Okay. There's a few things. Go ahead, Tor.
I was just going to ask a dumb question about this. If I have a var somewhere, let's say it's a global variable,
yep.
right? And then I reference that from within, you know, as the label of a button or whatever. That property, global variable, you know, has a setter. It can change. But you don't treat that as something you track, right? Like I would have to do some additional annotation to say, actually, I want you to do tracking on this. Is that correct?
That's right. So you need to either the object itself that's changing itself needs to be annotated as that model, and then it's trackable. We have like these little state objects that we've again kind of followed this idea that Kotlin uses for like, so Kotlin collections almost all have this idea of like a split in interfaces versus like the read-only version of a list versus the mutable list. Live data followed this pattern as well. You've got live data and then you've got mutable live data in terms of like who has access to write to something. So one of the changes that we've made since the ADS release is that this capital S state object that we have, it's just a single value holder, but it's a model single value holder. It's a trackable single value holder. So we have like state and we have mutable state that just holds a single instance of something. So this is kind of like your trackable val or var that you can pass around as part of that. Now, if you just capture a var from either like a global scope or somewhere around it, we're looking at ways to turn that into either like a compiler warning or error to begin with, because it's almost always like the wrong thing.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, my first run in with the plus operator again, was that I was trying to figure out why it wasn't updating, why it just kept staying the same value, because I hadn't understood this concept, right? That you just capture the value once and that's it. It's not, just because it's mutable doesn't mean it's being tracked, even though I was under the impression that you know, Compose does that as a compiler plugin. It's figuring out what's mutable, what isn't. Well, not quite. And so right. I think if you could do a warning, that would be nice.
Yeah, and we're looking at that too. Like I think, and the nice thing is that once you encounter this sort of warning, there's a really nice, easy, quick fix to a bunch of it too. And again, I think this kind of owes to just how much we get from using Kotlin as a baseline for this, is Kotlin does property delegates. So for example, if you have one of these state effects, you can say, what is it, like var my foo by state of here's my initial value. And that then just works. And from that point forward in your code, you treat it like a var. You can read from it, you can write to it, and there's nothing special. Even if the type that you're holding within it isn't specially annotated, now you get all of the sort of change tracking involved with that.
Sounds good.
I think if I understood correctly, you were asking for a new lint rule.
No, I'm happy for the compiler itself, our compiler plugin, to enforce this.
Okay.
I don't want to try to replicate the data flow analysis of whatever you're doing in the compiler plugin for this.
Yeah, in this case, it's mostly just Lambda Capture that we're going to be tracking for it.
Yeah, and I think Kotlin itself is pretty good about this too. They have the compiler itself checking for a lot of things. Which I think is a good thing, because then it's always consistent across, you know, the compilation on the command line and ID and all that.
So you mentioned at model and state. There's another thing we can track, right? We have the observe effect. Has it changed name? I think we're talking about changing the name.
The observe effect, which one?
For live data and...
Oh, yeah. So this is one of those things that I don't think that we ever actually put it into the Compose libraries to begin with, but I think between Leland, me, and a few other people, we've like pasted the same code snippet into I don't know how many slides or chat channels or anything like that. But I mean, that's kind of the strength of it too, is it shows like, yeah, if you have your own observable data type, you can tie it into the Compose system very, very easily. Like the reason why we pasted this snippet everywhere is it's like 8 lines of code max, something like that.
So effectively, if you have a system whereby, let's say you already have a notification system, listener, whatever, when the data changes, you can easily write a small wrapper that will make it compatible with Compose.
Right, exactly. So if you use RxJava or Kotlin Flow or anything like that, you can observe. You can take a subscription to one of these observable objects and just say, hey, val current value equals observe my object. And the whole thing just works from there. So the surrounding context will be rerun whenever a new value is emitted from that subscription. And on top of that, we can do the subscription tracking for you. So if that instance of, say, your button or your card or whatever it is that's showing this, if that instance disappears from the composition, we'll tear down the subscription for you, clean it up. You don't have to do your own disposable or job tracking or anything like that.
It was one of the questions that I had was we had been making a lot of this observability stuff in lifecycle in general easier with the architecture component stuff that we've been developing, which was developed in the existing universe of Java stuff and obviously compatible with Kotlin. Like, to what extent do those things carry over into a composed world? And I think you just answered part of this. Like, if you are using live data and you're using, you know, that approach to observability, does that stuff just carry over into Compose, or is Compose itself and the compiler sort of replacing some of that stuff?
So we'll meet you where you are. Like, if you have tools that you like I think that it's Compose's job as a toolkit to be adaptable and come to you rather than asking that you come to it. So I think that, again, making sure that you can tie into these existing components is really important. To the other part of your question of like, what does it replace? Like, is there anything that you don't need anymore? Mm-hmm. There's a few things. I think that we're still kind of trying to sort out what the right answer for some of this is over time. And I think the answer is maybe a little bit different if you're writing a completely greenfield app versus you have an existing app as well. I think that there's certain parts of like app model objects that have a lot of parity with an Arch Components view model object full of live datas, for example. You have all these little individual observable pieces, and you have some object that holds them that you can access from some other parts of your system. You'll do so fairly frequently. And there's something about that object that sort of persists over time. In the case of the Arch Components view model, it sort of traverses the activity recreations that happen across configuration changes. So we're looking at how we can tie that sort of thing. Like, we'll probably even use the Arch Components view model for it under the hood as a mechanism of like how much of the composition state can we transfer from activity recreation in the case of an existing app. In the case of a brand new app, you can just turn activity recreation off for configuration changes if you're using Compose for everything. Right. But the idea there is that like you can start expressing more of these things as just your own objects that aren't particularly special, rather than having to necessarily subclass some of these existing types that are out there as well. So hopefully that leads to code that ends up being a lot smaller, more terse, kind of like Kotlin allows data classes to be much smaller and more terse than it would be elsewhere.
In general, that's what I really like about where Compose is right now, because modeling your data or even your widgets, composables, it only takes a couple lines of code, right, to create a new data model. Well, it's a data class and you annotate it, and then you create a function and you have your widget and that's it, as opposed to the current world where you have to create like that subclass of view, and you have to create your listeners, or you have to create an adapter for recycler view and all that stuff. Like and it changes the way you can write your app, because you can make much more specialized widgets and data classes much more easily. So you're going to be inclined to do so, which I think will make your code simpler and easier to write and understand.
Well, one of the things I know you talked about at Dev Summit too was as your team works on this, you are using public APIs, maybe creating public APIs as you need to, but making sure that the mechanisms you're using to create the views, the widgets that it ships with, will be able to be used by everybody else, right? Which is a difference from the current system where, maybe you wanted to make a custom view that was a whole lot like a text view. Oh my God, what about all this private capability that we sort of depend on, given history? So not only can you create these specialized widgets without as much overhead, but also hopefully you have the capabilities built in that make that a lot easier than it is today.
Yeah, I think that we're kind of embracing the idea that you can control click into the implementation of a standard library composable and see that there's something about it that you like, see that there's something about it that you would change, copy, paste, and just kind of move on after you've made those changes.
Yeah, and
Ramon, you did this at Android Dev Summit when you were coming up with the keynote demo, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, actually, it was because the vertical scroller had a bug.
Yeah, it was centering content by default.
And so my fix was exactly what you said. I command clicked it and there was 20 lines of code, copy pasted, fixed the bug, and that was it. Like that was done. Whereas, very often with the current Android platform, it would be more than 20 lines of code and they would most likely not compile in your app because they would call into private APIs that you don't have access to. And again, I think, for us, the beauty of this is simplifying the implementation and encouraging app developers to go and do exactly that, because if you see it's only a few lines of code, you're not going to be intimidated.
But it sounds like the opposite of compose, right? Composing is like reusing pieces. And you're like, no, just copy paste as much as you want.
But those lines are reusing existing pieces. If you look at vertical scroller, it's a bunch of existing pieces nested together. If you look at button or checkbox, it's a few reusable components.
Right. It's like the vertical scroller was so easy for you to copy paste and change, because all it is, hey, it's a gesture detector wrapped around a container that like we measure with an infinite height.
Yeah,
and it also means, if you want to do something earlier crazier than that, then it becomes very trivial to do so, because you're just reusing those pieces that are there. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that at ADS and at IO, but I think it's very interesting to go look at the source code of some of the widgets, especially, things like the checkbox or the button, and to see how simple they are. And if you want to create your own, you can do so from scratch very easily.
That's a bit different from going in and looking at the Kotlin standard library, which I did early on in learning Kotlin. I was pretty intimidated.
Wait, what? The Kotlin standard library is full of functions that are like four lines long.
No, it's very impressive, but
it depends.
The extension.
Have you looked at the coroutine
functions?
Yeah.
Yes, that's also some great code. I learned a lot from
I'm not saying the code is bad.
Complex.
All I'm saying is
it's a little bit more complex.
I think looking at Compose, you're like, oh, this is clean. I could have written that. And you look at, especially as a Kotlin newbie, looking at the Kotlin runtime, they're using a lot of stuff you might not be aware of yet.
And it builds on each other too. Control clicking on that thing took me to a function that was two lines long, which is awesome. But that function, was a subclass of this other thing that built on this other interface over there. And it's hard to get that context in your mind at one point. At one point, trying to figure out how some of the language features worked for the one of the talks that we did, I ended up just setting a breakpoint and seeing what the call stack was, because I could not get there from clicking on code and finding out what the implementation was going to be at runtime.
So you're saying that clicking on code in the standard libraries is kind of like clicking a link to TV tropes?
It could be if I understood
day?
The reference.
Oh. Yeah. Wikipedia,
kind of.
How about
yes.
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and hopefully we won't have that with Compose. Like, you bottom out pretty quickly.
Well, I mean, hopefully you keep clicking because you think it's interesting, but yes.
Yeah, and you realize that all the way down it's fairly simple.
So if we get things right, yeah.
Can I take you back to toward the beginning of the conversation when I was talking about this horrible thing I did where I ended up writing a Compose app that wasn't using the Compose compiler, and we recommend that absolutely nobody on the planet do this, and I was doing the wrong thing, and it was a horrible thing to do, and I did it anyway. But you said that will stop working at some point. Can I ask you why and what the new thing is going to be?
So, long story short, it's still going to be a long story. So the if you compare against something like a suspend in Kotlin today, like the suspend keyword when you put it on a function says, hey, please do some special mangling to this function. It's going to take some extra parameters in the form of like a continuation. It's going to return a special object that the rest of the language is going to treat specially, et cetera, et cetera. The actual signature of the function, if you were to dive down using like reflection, using kind of like the java.reflect libraries or something like that, it's going to look a little bit different at that point. And
quite different.
And right now there's a series of changes in progress for Compose that are going to do pretty much the same thing. And we're doing this so that we can pass the special composer object through the call chain of everything in your composable functions to begin with, rather than sort of referring to some other like global state that was part of the composition in the past, which it kind of worked by accident if you didn't have the plugin enabled before. Yeah. And now it'll just break really hard.
Okay. So it's not just to stop people from doing this horrible thing. It's because the functionality...
We want compiler support, because we tried, right? And if you don't have the right compiler plugin, obviously...
It's because we tried very hard to not be different from standard Kotlin, and we succeed so much that
we're really different from standard Kotlin.
Sorry,
we succeeded so much that we're really different from standard Kotlin.
That we're not. That you can compile with a regular compiler without the plugin. Right. And yeah. I remember because just before IDS, a bunch of folks saw that we were staging the binaries and they started playing with Compose, and they're like, "Look, I built an app." We're like, "Yeah, it doesn't work." Like, "No, it compiled. It works." Yeah. No, it looks like it's working.
Well, they got some data changes to work.
Like, yeah, some of it works, not all of it. In terms of ergonomics, we
need the confidence of hey, it compiled, so
therefore it works.
That's how you ship code, isn't it?
The first time you launch it looks like it's working.
So it's passing around an implicit or a hidden argument. It reminds me, isn't it like the this item in C++ code that sort of gets passed around to all the functions?
I don't know what you mean.
A little bit yes, a little bit no. I mean, it is an implicit parameter. It does come from kind of like the rest of the context that it's called from. It does mean that you can only call a composable function from within another composable function, and you need to have like a bootstrap process in order to get from non-compose code into compose code. So again, there's a lot of parallels with suspend in there.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, you're not going to be able to do what you did before, because in order to do it, you would need to have an instance of this composer object that you can't otherwise get.
Right.
And it needs to be the right instance of it that holds like the current composition state in its current form and so on and so forth. And part of the reason why we're doing this is that it kind of opens the door to a lot of other optimizations down the line. It means that we'll be able to do a lot more with kind of concurrency and multi-threading and kind of like try and do other forms of like parallel recomposition to try and take advantage of the multi-core CPUs on some of these devices.
It's also important to be able to mix and match different composition trees. Because right now, I mean, already we have different trees. There's the draw one, there's the widgets. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember how it works today, but it will be much cleaner once we can pass the composition context.
But you said something interesting. I mean, you have all along, but you mentioned the threading. So I'm under the impression that right now a lot of our toolkit runs on the UI thread.
That's right.
And you just said that we can run stuff in other threads. Say more about that.
Sure. We can run stuff on other threads. No, I mean, some of this kind of comes from the form that we're putting a lot of this into. So Romain mentioned earlier that we're using lambdas to represent the body of a lot of Compose containers and such. The nice thing about that is that there's kind of some expectations that you bring in when you see that in a piece of code. You expect that this is something that is represented sequentially in this piece of code. And while that may be true in the context of the layout, like if you have say a column that includes items 1, 2, 3, and each one of those has like a body that includes several other subcomponents, then you know that when this thing is displayed on screen, there's kind of an order to some of these things. But since we're actually capturing blocks of code as the body of each one of these things, we can isolate that from the rest of the context that it's run in. So we can, if we invalidate something later, we can invalidate each one of those things individually if the data dependencies are right.
Again, coroutines, right? That when you call suspend function, that's kind of what's going on. You have the string lambdas, and they're not executed like right now. They can be executed later on multiple threads, like.
Right, and at that point, it's an API decision, right. In the same way it is here. So we're kind of looking at what we might do to, again, be able to compose parts of a UI in parallel with one another, or even just like in isolation from one another.
But does that mean that the code I write in a lambda inside of a composable function could be invoked not on the UI thread?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
So this is why the data that you pass into a composable function should be passed in as a parameter. So, like, probably don't go fishing around in thread unsafe objects as you're doing things like this.
Right. But, like, if I have a hybrid app, right, that has Compose and has classic Android, I have to be really careful.
Well, you can always pass your data, like Adam said, like, as input to those functions or through your data, your add model objects.
Yeah, but if my data is an Android view.view and I choose to call some method on it from my composable, that probably would be a bad idea, I would think.
You're doing this, do you have all other issues?
But. Well, we're gonna have some. So you're saying that if you're using a standard view today, like within a compose hierarchy,
yeah,
we're gonna
have some screen that has some Android UI with like an edit text, and I decided in my composable to get the value of the edit text for some processing. I should be careful, right?
You should be pretty careful, but I think that the form that'll end up taking is we're able to provide, again, like this is the flexibility that Kotlin gives us in terms of this API design. If we offer some sort of a view interaction API to say, hey, I'm going to like host this sub hierarchy of views right here in my compose hierarchy, mm-hmm. then we can guarantee that the body lambda of that particular block, well, this one will always run on the UI thread because we know that we have to do that because that's the only way to do it safely. And you as the developer don't necessarily need to think about this because we're able to think about it for you so that you can just write your code naturally.
But for example, you could also listen to text changes on the text view, get the data, put it in a model, or pass it to a composable function this way. Like, okay. Take the data.
No, that would be the right way to do it. I'm just looking for.
Right.
I'm just looking for what people will do.
And those discussions about using multiple threads potentially. We've been talking about this for a long, long time now.
Oh yeah.
Multi-threaded toolkits. It's pretty difficult.
Yeah, and it depends. There are multiple ways of multi-threading because here we're talking about the composition, but then you have the measure pass, the layout pass, the drawing pass. I mean, the drawing pass already split into like, should we multi-thread that? Can it be multi-threaded?
Well, drawing's been multi-threaded for years at this point, thanks to some other stuff under the hood. Like, I mean, this is the thing, is that the runtime that you're working with can do a lot of this under the hood for
what
you
I was getting
and still
at
present
is,
a very simple model.
What I was getting at is there's a number of things we can do. Some of them might affect the way you write your code, back to your example, Tor. And so we wanted to proceed very carefully to make sure that whatever it is we decide is not going to make, it's very difficult to write compose code.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why we're pretty confident in this sort of direction so far and why we don't think it's going to cause a lot of problems is because if you're writing the kind of code that is going to have a lot of problems in a multi-threaded context like this, chances are, and this is kind of a humorous way to look at it, but chances are your code's already broken thanks to the way that we sort of restart selectively and we're able to invalidate just like a sub piece of UI. And this also comes back to what you said before about if you just like capture a var and then you're reading and writing to it like within a lambda capture for one thing or another, you might be trying to reason about the state of that variable in some sort of other surrounding context. And that's just like fundamentally a very difficult thing to do effectively, considering the way that we are going to restart some of these things. So if you have
that's actually a very good point. Even without multiple threads, like you can be on the same thread, but it's deferred execution, right? So you don't know when that code's going to execute. And we've seen that even with the UI thread in the current toolkit, where we have a number of bugs both in apps and the toolkit itself, where we do everything on a single thread, but the order of execution sometimes causes surprises. And you don't do things in the right order and you have bugs anyway.
Right, exactly. So I think that we've kind of embraced a lot of that with Compose and sort of realized, okay, this is this is the reality of the problem space that we're dealing with. Even if we're not necessarily parallel, we are concurrent, we are asynchronous, even in the case of just dealing with something on a single UI thread. And as a result, we've kind of made sure that we have all the primitives in place that can help you deal with that and help make that an effective environment to program in. So like in the case of like var captures within composable lambdas being kind of a dangerous thing to do, well, we give you a way around it. We say like, oh, okay, well, you probably meant to write this as by state, and then we'll go ahead and fix everything else up for you and everything will just start working again the way that you expect.
So lint rules?
Might need those, yeah.
So an implicit part of your question was the fact that we do expect Compose to be able to inhabit the same universe as existing view hierarchies or views, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk about how that, I don't know if that actually works right now, how it actually works or how you plan for it to work, because clearly there are different systems.
One part of it has to work already today, since activity expects a view at the root. So. Yeah.
Exactly. So I mean, like the set content extension that we've got that kind of bootstraps you into Compose today from like an activity or a view group or anything like that, just puts Compose content into a view group as it exists today. So that direction is working pretty smoothly. The other direction, it's a little bit rough. You have to get involved with some very raw API surfaces that we haven't kind of gone back and really cleaned up for like wide consumption yet. But you can poke around in the repository, and we have, for example, a composable function that hosts a web view. It's just a standard Android web view, and you can poke URLs at it and find out sort of where it's going, place it within a Compose hierarchy, and it works.
Okay, so you're saying the direction Compose is taking is that it's basically just going to be a host for a web view. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That and it'll fix all bugs. Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay, web view. All right.
So what are you excited for next? Compose is not ready yet for production. There's still a lot of features. And, you know, we have developers who keep asking about things like accessibility and constraint layout and whatnot. So what does personally excite you that's coming?
Suspend fully working in the IR compiler that we're based on.
Right. So the IR compiler is the new backend for the Kotlin compiler that we rely on in Compose, and it's not quite ready.
Well, not only that, but we're on kind of an old version too. Right. Like it's been a little while since we rebased against upstream at this point, and there are still some bugs that like we've heard that there's been some progress on them. We haven't had a chance to kind of check it out yet, but I think that that's going to unlock a lot of API advancement throughout the Compose UI system that I think is going to make things really, really nice to develop with.
I think that was one of the things that made my demo particularly hard to get working on Compose the way it was supposed to, was I had coroutines already in use. And so like this was a thing that does not work with Compose right now, or at least it didn't at the time.
Yeah, you have to jump through some really big hoops with it. You can manage to make it work if you set up your modules correctly and you say that I want to compile module A with the Compose compiler and the IR compiler with the Compose plugin. Yeah. I want to compile module B with this other one. You can form like module sandwiches to make the dependencies work out right. And like you can do the wire up as long as you're willing to have like a separation in files between here's the file where my Compose code is, here's the file where my coroutines code is. It's a pain in the neck, but like if you do spend a little bit of time setting that up today, again, we're way pre-alpha at this point, and we're kind of bringing a bunch of this stuff online, but you can see where we're going with it. And I think that's been really exciting for me, is to kind of see like, okay, this is sort of the path of what we'll be able to build. People build a lot of really complicated libraries around things like image and content loading, for example, on Android. And there are some really, really good ones out there, ones that tie into a lot of our existing Arch components and lifecycle management stuff. But those kind of have to be tied in at a much higher level. Like you have to perform like a lot of these other sort of wire up steps, or these libraries have to really go to great lengths to get the lifecycle wire up right. And Compose will allow you to do this sort of thing just in line. So to be able to say, hey, here's like a val of the current avatar image that I'm going to show here. And val my avatar equals load async of, hey, here's some URL that I want to load from. And then you can say, oh, well, if it returns null, so just question colon placeholder image. And then you have it render your image out right after that. And you've expressed a fundamentally asynchronous operation that in many cases is a lot more difficult to do elsewhere in a very short amount of code.
All right. I'm all out of questions. Tor, You've been dominating the conversation so far. Do you have anything else to add?
No, this is super interesting. I can't wait to see where we end up.
And a reminder for our listeners that all the development is happening in OSP. So if you want to follow what's going on in Compose, like the new APIs, how it's evolving, you can just watch the commits.
Yeah, what's the normal URL for it? It's android-review.googlesource.com.
Google.com, AndroidX,
we will
AOSP.
Put the link in the show notes.
Sounds good.
Sure, we will.
Yeah, right. We're looking at what we can do to try to like get more releases out so that folks can take advantage of some of the things that we've talked about here as well. So we're trying to figure out exactly what the right cadence for some of this stuff is. But we know people are excited and we want to get it out there.
Stay tuned. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.